And yet the royal family has dissented from this long-established national practice by their ability, since 1910, to seal their wills. The untimely death in 1910 of errant Prince Francis, the brother-in-law of King George V, set in stone a tradition which the British royal family jealously guards to this day: the concept and practice of sealed wills. The catalyst for the un-British practice of sealed wills was Prince Francis' erratic, if not reckless, lifestyle, best exemplified by his compulsive gambling and extreme womanizing. In his will, Francis is believed to have left priceless family jewels to one of his more flamboyant mistresses, Ellen Constance, the Countess of Kilmery, with whom he was rumoured to have had an illegitimate child. This significant act of indiscretion and breach of protocol spurred the royal family into action, first by suppressing the will and subsequently reaching out to Ellen Constance with a hefty bribe, £10,000 to be exact, which amounts to £700,000 in today's money. For the past 100 years or so, English courts have upheld the monarchy's demand that wills of its members, in stark contrast to the wills of the general public, should be sealed and, in effect, kept secret in perpetuity. On the few occasions when this self-declared right to secrecy has been challenged in the courts, notably in 2006 by one Robert Brown, who claims he is an illegitimate child of the deceased Princess Margaret, this has been quashed by the Queen's judges. The precedent set by the suppression of the will of Prince Francis, above all, demonstrates that the British legal system, rooted firmly in the principles of English law, never flinches when it comes to accommodating the whims and fancies of the monarchy. This was in evidence, most recently, in the aftermath of the demise of Elizabeth Angela Marguerite Bowes Loyne, also known as the Queen Mother, who died in March 2002.
A mother, a mum, the Queen Mum.
In keeping with royal tradition, established in 1910 in the wake of Prince Francis's demise, the Queen Mother's will was sealed up on the orders of the High Court, which means that on present trajectory, in view of the total hegemony of the monarchy, it is closed to inspection and publication in perpetuity. The blanket secrecy surrounding royal wills is central to the secrecy in which they conduct all their personal affairs. From wealth accumulation to the conduct of sordid affairs and other scandalous relationships, the case of Diana's husband, Prince Charles, speaks volumes. Diana's husband and her heir to the throne, who is no stranger to sordid and secret affairs. Charles's most infamous escapades was with his childhood sweetheart, Camilla Parker Bowles, with whom he started a secret affair in 1986, 5 years after his marriage with Diana. This is the same Prince Charles whose love for hunting animals is equal to, if not excessive of, his love for human flesh. An avid fox hunter, Charles once famously said he would not stop hunting foxes in the British countryside until the practice was made illegal. Fox hunting was made illegal in the UK in November 2004, and while it is not known if Prince Charles partakes in these illegal hunts, it is well known that for years he lobbied former Prime Minister Tony Blair to repeal the ban. By all credible accounts, Charles's brother Andrew is more morally compromised, as evidenced by his long-standing relationship with the deceased American paedophile Jeffrey Epstein. Pre- Prince Andrew, or the Duke of York to use his formal title, is the quintessential royal playboy, as demonstrated by his long list of romantic entanglements, even after his ill-fated marriage to Sarah Ferguson in 1986. Beginning in 1980, the Duke of York has conducted affairs with an astonishing number of glamorous women, including the former Playboy model Courtney Love, reality TV star Caroline Stanbury, and the American photographer and actress Koo Stark. Andrew's wife of 10 years, the notoriously volatile Sarah Ferguson, was also no stranger to scandal and sordid affairs. Her immoral and carefree lifestyle exploded onto the public domain after photos of her lounging by the pool with her financial advisor, the Texan millionaire John Bryan, kissing and sucking her toes were published. However, what the British public sees in the way of royal scandals, which erupt onto the public sphere from time to time, is merely the tip of the proverbial iceberg. Plenty of dodgy dealings take place behind the scenes, which the public never hears about, as the monarchy's ironclad secrecy, enforced by the courts and broader machinery of state, shows no sign of relenting. The British monarchy exerts influence from behind the scenes in a carefully choreographed effort to present the British system as a parliamentary democracy, with minimal interference in the nation's day-to-day affairs by the Queen. But like everything else in modern Britain, appearances can be deceptive. Even the most intrinsic feature of modern government, namely legislation. On the surface, the process of legislation in the UK is undertaken by both the Houses of Parliament and the government of the day, playing a central role in introducing proposed legislation in the form of bills. But the monarch plays an influential role both at the beginning and end of the legislative process through the Queen's consent and assent. With the former signifying the sovereign's agreement with parliamentary debate on a proposed piece of legislation, and the latter marking the sovereign's seal of approval to a bill that has successfully completed the parliamentary process.
Very grateful, and I think my views on this are pretty well understood.
Indeed, a bill only becomes an act or law of the land once it has been granted royal assent by the Queen. It might be argued that none of this dissents in a fundamental way from the principles of constitutional monarchy insofar as the sovereign is expected to play a symbolic role in the legislative process. But nothing could be further from the truth. As the Queen actively employs her power of withholding consent for proposed legislation, often in concert with and the active collusion of a sitting government. This often occurs when a sitting government wants to stop proposed legislation which originates from the inner circles of policymaking. Therefore, briefing the Queen and persuading her to withhold her consent from the bill, to be even discussed in Parliament, is the most effective way of stopping inconvenient proposed legislation in its tracks. In keeping with the British tradition of secrecy, records are not kept as to how many times the Queen has exercised her power to withhold consent from proposed legislation entering the parliamentary fray.
In the House of Peers.
But the public know of at least three occasions. The Titles Bill, 1964. The Rhodesia Independence Bill, 1969. And the Military Action Against Iraq Bill, 1999. On all three occasions, the bills were proposed by backbenchers in the House of Commons, and on all three occasions, the sitting government quashed the initiatives by way of persuading the Queen to intervene.
That her attack on the BBC.
In fact, whereas the UK is continually at pains to project itself as the world's leading parliamentary democracy, with Parliament supposedly acting as the will of the people, the truth is that an unelected sovereign plays a central role in the legislative process, both in passive and active capacities. In February 2021, The Guardian revealed that more than 1,000 laws have been vetted by the Queen or Prince Charles through a secretive procedure before they were approved by the UK's elected members of Parliament. The huge number of laws subject to royal vetting cover matters ranging from justice, social security, pensions, race relations, and food policy, through to obscure rules on car parking charges and hovercraft. The wealth of the royal family in terms of fixed assets is concentrated in two crown bodies, the Duchy of Lancaster and Duchy of Cornwall. The Duchy of Lancaster is by far the most consequential, as it constitutes the private estate of the sovereign Queen Elizabeth II. The Duchy of Cornwall, meanwhile, belongs to the eldest son of the reigning monarch, which currently is Prince Charles. These holdings, or crown bodies, to use British political jargon, merely represents the vast estates, including palaces, that belong to the royal family and which the state upkeeps with taxpayers' money. But the Queen's wealth, as well as other leading members of the royal family, exceeds the value of the buildings and lands held by the two duchies. As far back as 2001, the Mail on Sunday calculated that the Queen was worth £1.15 billion, with her vast investment portfolio worth £500 million alone. The Queen reportedly is an avid collector of expensive and exotic items. Her stamp collection alone was worth an eye-watering £100 million. But as faithful as he was to the pertinent facts, Hall's description was, by all credible accounts, an underestimate. In 2017, the Paradise Paper leak revealed that millions of pounds from the private estate of Britain's Queen Elizabeth II had been invested in offshore tax haven funds. The family doesn't have to pay a single penny for the upkeep of the vast estates under their control. And needless to say, members of the royal household don't pay a single penny in income tax either, or any other form of tax for that matter. And that's just the beginning, as the royal family receives a more than generous stipend from the state to maintain their lavish lifestyles, all at the expense of the out-of-pocket British taxpayer. The current legislative framework for funding the lifestyle and expenses of the royal family is embodied in the Sovereign Grant Act 2011, which replaced the civil list mechanism established by King George III in 1760. On the face of it, the new arrangement is advantageous to the monarchy, as income from the old civil list in the years 2001 to 2011 was fixed at £7.9 million annually. By contrast, in 2012, the new sovereign grant scheme funneled an exorbitant £1 million into the pockets of the royal household. In the year 2018 to 2019, this had increased to a staggering £82.8 million, and by all accounts, it is set to rise by at least 8 to 10% annually for the foreseeable future. To place financial arrangements on a more favourable footing, the royals could always rely on the Tory party, which had for the past 180 years, since its foundation in the 1830s, championed the cause of monarchy as part of its broader right-wing political and ideological agenda.
If Parliament were a school.
When the Conservative Party came to power following the May 2010 general election, albeit as part of a coalition government with the Liberal Democrats, they quickly set about abolishing the civil list arrangement of 1760. The then Tory Chancellor, George Osborne, contrived a scheme doubtless in close consultation with the Queen and her son Prince Charles, which would replace the 1760 deal with a new arrangement whereby a percentage of the profits of the Crown Estate would be diverted to royal accounts. This was initially set at 15% of profits annually, but has subsequently been increased to 25% to cover a bells and whistles upgrade to Buckingham Palace. Osborne and the Tories went the extra mile to please the Queen and her eldest son. For, as part of the New Deal, if income from the Crown Estates fell one year, the royals would be compensated for the loss. And vice versa, in the event of above-inflation income stream, the royals get to pocket the excess. The arrangement of 2011 has all the trappings of placing the royal family above the vicissitudes of the British economy. Despite its massive constitutional significance and considerable financial implications, information about this new arrangement was kept to a small circle within the government. It was rushed through a small committee in the House of Commons, with only the Scottish National Party objecting to its terms.
This is almost the kind of behaviour we would expect to see in the Duma in Moscow.
To make matters worse, the draft legislation was personally delivered to Prince Charles by the pliant Tory Chancellor Osborne so that the Queen's eldest son could issue his consent to the proposed legislation. Britain is not an anomaly in Europe in terms of having a monarchy. Excluding the UK, there are 9 monarchies left in Europe. But what sets the European monarchies apart from Britain's royal family is their genuine and robust constitutional status, in addition to multiple layers of oversight exercised over them to prevent abuse of power and privilege. For example, under Article 19 of the Norwegian Constitution, in order for the king to accede to the throne, he has to make the following pledge: I promise and swear that I will govern the Kingdom of Norway in accordance with the Constitution. Similarly, Article 32 of the Dutch Constitution requires that the king shall swear or promise allegiance to the Constitution and that he will faithfully discharge his duties. The remaining monarchies in Europe are truly constitutional, insofar as they are subordinate to the policies which they purport to represent. By stark contrast, the British monarchy stands not only above democracy, but above the law itself. Indeed, they like to think they are the law, inasmuch as they do whatever they please, including accumulating wealth without paying a penny in tax. Seen in this context, the British royal family constitutes Europe's largest imperial monarchy, apparently impervious to the vicissitudes of politics and history. It doesn't stop there, as even their upkeep far exceeds that of their European counterparts. The decadence and greed of the British monarchy puts European monarchies, indeed monarchies across the world, to shame. As for palaces, for example, the Spanish, Dutch and Danish royal families each have access to only 2 palaces. The House of Windsor, meanwhile, occupies 15 state residences, and that figure excludes privately owned estates like Balmoral Castle and Sandringham House. Monarchies around the world are adapting fast to political developments, if only to ensure their survival in an age of forensic scrutiny. Japan, which credibly claims to be the oldest monarchy in the world, is leading the way by trying to create as much distance as possible between the royal family and public expenditure. Prince Akishino, who is next in line to succeed Emperor Naruhito, announced that the royal family should cover the expense of succession ceremony from its own funds, as opposed to relying on the state treasury to cover the costs. This is a world away from the dreamscape occupied by Queen Elizabeth II, her heirs and entourage. Despite their vast wealth, the royals make liberal use of public resources for their own pleasure and comfort. For instance, Prince William, who many believe will be the next king as Charles may abdicate in favour of his oldest son, once used a military helicopter to fly to a stag party. By the same token, the royals are not shy of using fabulously wealthy people's private resources either. In 2018, the American actor and producer George Clooney treated Prince Harry and his wife Meghan Markle to a decadent holiday in Italy. Clooney reportedly flew the royal couple there in his private jet and gave them unfettered access to his luxurious 25-room villa. The question is, what, if anything, Clooney got in return for his extraordinary generosity? When the scandal about the couple's penchant for private jets first broke out, some observers were puzzled as to why the singer and songwriter Elton John had been so keen to leap to Harry and Meghan's defence. The answer may lie in the fact that the royal family uses its wealth and privilege to cultivate famous and influential types, exactly for such occasions when it needs to polish up its public image. Modern Britain is a country of contrasts, not to mention deep contradictions. The dizzyingly complex mix of traditions, mores, and an apparently insatiable postmodern impulse has created a country that is hard to decipher, let alone fully understand. And so it is with the monarchy. On the surface, most Britons appear to support the antiquated institution, not just on the grounds of sentimentalism, but also good old-fashioned British pragmatism. And yet, the UK is home to a small but vocal Republican community.
I'm here to protest the unaccountable power of the Crown. What it symbolises, which is hereditary privilege, and the constitutional power that it still has.
We don't need that kind of icon. No, much better icons are, you know, things like ideas like democracy and the equality of citizenship, and maybe someone chosen by us to represent us.
The fact of the matter is, there is no credible evidence or indication even that the British public wants to abolish the monarchy, except for very cosmetic changes to the monarchy and only to placate public anger, never to reform the monarchy itself. Based on this clear political reality, the British monarchy is set to survive the 21st century, perhaps with little, if any, substantial change. But a parallel development points to the diminution of the UK's role in the world, perhaps even the breakup of the UK itself, as evidenced by the strengthening independence movement in Scotland and, to a lesser extent, Wales. As Britain becomes more parochial, the rest of the world is likely to care much less about the House of Windsor, and that may be a punishment worse than death for Britain's media-conscious royal family.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding.
IRIB English Radio.
Limelight. Promises of jobs and investment are doing little to convince a remote Lincolnshire community to agree to hosting the UK's nuclear waste. In this regard, we have prepared for you an article written by Sandra Laville titled, "It's a Bribe: The Coastal Areas That Could Become the UK's Nuclear Dump." Please stay with us to hear more about the story. On the unspoilt Lincolnshire coast, where walkers enjoy the 5 miles of golden sandy beach and families take holidays in the caravan parks beyond the dunes, the efforts of British politicians to persuade the public nuclear energy is green, safe and clean do not seem to be gaining traction. A skull glowers down from the sand dunes to the Mablethorpe beach, a portent of death and destruction, and a throwback to the campaign for nuclear disarmament protest of 1980s. It is here, in a 24-hectare disused gas terminal bordering the beach, that Prime Minister Boris Johnson's big bet on nuclear energy is being tested. Experts on nuclear waste have said that until the UK builds a large underground nuclear waste dump or geological deposit facility, or GDF, to safely store the 700,000 cubic meters of radioactive waste from the country's 20th century nuclear program, two new nuclear plants should be created. It is a problem that has dogged the development of nuclear energy not only in the UK, but across Europe and in the US. How to safely and permanently store the back end of the nuclear fuel cycle. The solution of the GDF was put forward nearly 50 years ago, but the UK is no nearer to putting spades into the ground, and the cost of decommissioning and disposing of the country's radioactive waste has risen to £131 billion. When the Prime Minister recently promised 8 new nuclear plants in as many years, the problem of the highly radioactive waste they would add to the stockpile was not mentioned. However, it is something very much at the forefront of the minds of those living in the remote Lincolnshire village of Teddlethorpe and the neighbouring town of Mablethorpe. Residents learned the seaside resort could become home to a vast nuclear dump, not from officials, but when a local BBC news programme broke the story revealing talks had been taken place for 2 years. According to documents from Radioactive Waste Management, now part of the Nuclear Waste Services, NWS, the gas terminal site is under consideration for the onshore facility, and the dump would be docked 6 miles off Mablethorpe Beach, between 200 and 1,000 meters below the sea. It would be made up of subterranean tunnels and vaults with natural and artificial barriers to minimize the escape of radioactivity. Inside, the waste from the past 50 years of nuclear programs, most of which is temporarily stored at Sellafield at Cumbria, would be deposited and sealed off forever. The dam would also have room for another 73,000 cubic metric of waste from a new nuclear program of up to 16 GW. The revelations sparked a grassroots protest, which appears to have spread quickly among the retired population, many of whom moved to the area for its coastal beauty. Anti-nuclear signs dominate country lanes, skeletons have been erected on the beach and outside homes, and a series of public meetings have been held over the past 8 months by a group called Guardians of the East Coast. Sarah Bright, who lives in Mablethorpe, says, "I was totally shocked when we found out," adding, "this area was just not elsewhere we ever thought they would put a nuclear dump. This is a tourist area. We have this beautiful beach. There is investment in tourism here. We rely on that tourism income, and the idea that they could consider putting a nuclear dome here is just shocking to me." It is responses such as these that have repeatedly seen off attempts to build an underground dump for nuclear waste in the UK. One 9 years ago in Cumbria was rejected after an impassioned campaign by environmentalists and local people. However, NWS says this time the approach has been different. The government agency privately acknowledges that attempts in the past to find a site for dump have been shrouded in secrecy. Any location for GDF has to be based on science, the geology of the area, and the technical requirements of a mammoth engineering project. Crucially, though, the community that will host it must also be supportive. This time, NWS invited communities to put their area forward. Four areas have identified themselves as willing to consider hosting the facility: Allerdale, Mid Copeland, and South Copeland in Cumbria, and Teddeltorpe. NWS promises the community that hosts the dump will benefit from great economic development opportunities, including jobs and investment in roads and railways. In Lincolnshire, a community partnership is in the process of being set up. John Collins, a former leader of Nottingham City Council and the independent chair of the working party set up in Teddeltorpe to decide on GDF, has been holding meetings to provide information and answer questions from local people for several months. He says, "If this was just a process of someone trying to sell an idea to the community, I would not have been interested in taking part," claiming, "what I think is really interesting in public opinion terms is that sense of this is a big infrastructure project and it has got local implications. We need to work with the community and we are asking the community to make a judgment on this at the end of the process, and if people don't want it, then it doesn't happen." John Collins claims, "We talk to people about safety, about why the area is being considered and what kind of timescale we are talking about," adding, "most people are reasonably open-minded. Some people are pretty much not in favor, and some are concerned about the potential impact locally." An initial assessment has concluded that the Lincolnshire site has the potential to host a GDF. Acknowledging the natural beauty of the area, NWS promises it will contribute to protecting conservation areas around the site and incorporate flood mitigation measures. The agency has also attempted to placate those who complain the dump will kill tourism in the area. The assessment claims there may be an opportunity to create a GDF Scientific Center of Excellence, which itself could generate significant visitor traffic and even become a tourism point of interest. For the Mablethorpe councillor and Labour leader on East Lindsay District Council, Tony Howard, NWS's promises on behalf of government are nothing more than a bribe. He said, "Suddenly they want us to have a nuclear dump and they are promising us railways, roads, local jobs. It's just 30 pieces of silver, a bribe. The idea that everyone is going to go from selling burgers in the summer to becoming nuclear experts and working on this site is ridiculous. There will be specialists brought in to do this work." He questions the very idea that nuclear energy is green, clean and safe at all, he said. We know very well in this area the dangers of nuclear. Every year we host children from Chernobyl who come to the seaside for a holiday. We are fully aware that if things go wrong at a site like this, they stay wrong permanently, and that does not sit well with trying to promote the town as a place with a super beach, which is wonderful for families. It jars, adding, we should be investing in solar, wind, desalination. This site would be perfect for that. Nuclear is a folly. Ken Smith of Guardians of East Coast is worried that the process of reaching a decision could take up to 15 years. He said, in that time, tourist investment will drain away. Why would you want to invest in a caravan park if you think a nuclear dump is going to be built next to it? This whole process should stop right now. As the tourist season in Mabel Tor begins, NWS appears to be spreading its pets, seeking other areas to come forward. Its director for community engagement and sitting Simon Hugh says the UK search for a suitable site is about engaging in dialogue with communities and building an understanding of what hosting a GDF might mean for them so that we can all make an informed decision. He asserted the previous process was very rigid and demanded decisions were made at set points and before all the information was available, claiming the new process allows communities to engage in a much more flexible way, allowing questions to be answered without commitment. Communities also have the option to withdraw from the process at any time and will have to give explicit consent before construction can commence. If the local community doesn't want it, it won't happen. Simon Hugh claimed, with over 60 years of legacy waste currently stored temporarily in surface sites around the country, developing a GDF is about delivering a safe, secure, and environmentally sound long-term solution that protects current and future generations, ensuring it works for the host community and the country as a whole.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed? Smiling, he would say, I am a Muslim. Din al-Islam, dini, wal-ardam ghayru dini, Muhammad illi hadini.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God. Welcome to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. We are going to talk about the rules of Hajj, in fact, according to Ayatollah Khamenei. But before that, let's take a listen to a short biography.
Mm-hmm.
little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtada Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, "We testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching makasas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up till 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and he's teaching, one can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that. Back to the program, Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio, with me, Muhammad Jawad Hossein, in this program, and Sheikh Javid, as always, our guest speaker in the studio. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh, and welcome to the program.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Well, let's talk about the significance of Hajj. Is Hajj an important ritual in the Islamic culture and for Muslims? Why do Muslims emphasize it so much? In fact, to go to Hajj, if capable, of course, economically speaking or otherwise. And could you please shed more light on this important ritual?
A'udhu billahi min shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. The Holy Quran says, وَلِلَّهِ عَلَى النَّاسِ حَجُّ الْبَيْتِ مَنِ اسْتَطَاعَ إِلَيْهِ سَبِيلًا وَمَنْ كَفَرَ فَإِنَّ اللَّهَ غَنِيٌّ عَنِ الْعَالَمِينَ. Based on this verse, of course, Hajj is one of the most essential and important pillars of Islam, upon which, of course, Islam has been established. Imam Baqir alayhi salatu wasalam says Islam has been established on the on five elements or on five pillars, mm-hmm. including prayer, zakat, fasting, hajj, and wilaya. So we see that according to the infallible imams, hajj, which is pilgrimage of the house of Allah, is considered to be one of the pillars of faith and one of the pillars of religion. And therefore, it is very much important that we give importance to Hajj.
Yes.
And whenever it is, whenever we are capable, according to the verse of the Holy Quran, mm-hmm. we have to act in a timely fashion to perform this pilgrimage. And of course, we should understand, we should have proper understanding of Hajj, because we have different kinds of Hajj, okay? We have obligatory Hajj and mustahab Hajj. The obligatory Hajj should be performed at a given time and in a special season, of course, you know very well.
Yes.
As far as the mustahab Hajj is concerned, of course, it can be performed at any time.
Mm-hmm.
And it is Hajj is mustahab for those people who for example, have already performed their Hajj, and
right.
they have relieved themselves of the obligation of performing Hajj, you know. Mm-hmm. And also Hajj is recommended for a person who is not capable, but he can still walk and go, or let's say reach Mecca by some means, okay. And so Hajj always remains mustahab for those people who cannot afford, for those people who have already performed their Hajj. And people should understand, and the mu'mineen or the believers should understand that the different kinds of Hajj. Of course, we will touch on the other types of Hajj, because
right.
we have Hajj Tamattu, Hajj Umrah, Qiran, and Ifrad. These are the different types of Hajj which are obligatory on different people, depending on where you live and where your house is. So, generally speaking, of course, Hajj holds or enjoys immense virtue and abundant reward. And of course, many traditions have been narrated from the Holy Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi wa sallam, and also the Ahlul Bayt alayhim wasallam, on the merits of Hajj, on the fadila of Hajj, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Imam Sadiq alayhi salatu wasallam, for example, has been reported to have said that those who perform Hajj and Umrah form the delegation of Allah. They are wafdullah, you know, they are the delegation of Allah. They are some, you know, representatives of Allah.
Right.
If they beg him, he will grant them. And if they call upon him, he will answer them. If they want to intercede for others, he will accept their intercession. Okay. And if they keep quiet, he will speak on their behalf, and they will be compensated with a reward for 1 million dirhams for the expense of one dirham. So if one person, if one pilgrim spends one dirham, he will be compensated, you know, a million times, you know.
Okay.
So that shows how important and how significant, how important, of course, the pilgrimage of the house of God is. And of course, there are
yes.
many benefits, socially speaking, politically
yes.
speaking.
Let me stop you there
yes.
actually for a short break, and then I'll ask you after we come back about the benefits of Hajj, all right?
Sure.
Thank you very much. Let's take a break, and we'll be back. Don't go away.
The followers of Ayatollah Khamenei can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the Library section, some of Ayatollah Khamenei's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Back to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program. And Sheikh Jawid is still in the studio talking about the significance of Hajj. And also you promised us just before the break about, you know, the benefits of Hajj. Would you elaborate on it a little bit? Thank you.
Of course, it has tremendous benefits for Muslims. You know, Muslims, it's especially when Muslims come together
right.
in Mecca,
mm-hmm.
it is an expression of unity for Muslims getting together.
Right.
That's why it's the proper term to use is Congress. You know, it's Hajj Congress, meaning that Muslims from all over the world come together in a show of unity. And they perform the same rituals, wearing the same garment, wearing the same, you know, clothing. and they rich and poor, you know, men and women, they walk together and they perform the same rituals. And this, you know, this ritual is repeated once in a year during the Hajj season. So it has a lot of benefits, especially when Muslims, you know, come together. They ask after, you know, each other's health, for example. They maybe conferences will be held there. You know, problems will be discussed, challenges will be discussed, and, you know, of course, solutions to those challenges will be offered and given. So different acts of Hajj have different meanings, and of course, Muslims who perform the Hajj not only perform the Hajj in compliance with God's command, because it's an act of it's an order from Allah, it's a commandment from Allah. People who perform Hajj, they basically perform it to comply with God's order, with God's command. And then, of course, the greater benefit is that by obeying God's command and complying with God's order, of course, one attains proximity to Allah. And of course, the goal of human creation is to attain proximity to Allah and ultimately find happiness, you know.
I see.
The eternal happiness, the ultimate happiness is achieved.
Right.
Of course, the closer we get to Allah, you know, the happier we will be at the end of the day.
Actually, that comes true whenever we are, in fact, following, you know, every act which is recommended and also made necessary or obligatory and recommended by God and His actually. Friends,
sure.
Right? Friends of God.
Every religious act, whether right. it is Hajj or it is prayer or zakat or fasting, should be performed with the intention of complying with God's order.
Right.
And of course, if it's done for the act of showing to other people or for gaining reputation, because there are people might be there. Mm-hmm. I'm saying there could be some. There might be some people who might want to perform Hajj in order to gain social status,
yes,
or to become, you know, to gain reputation among his people in the or in the community where he lives. So, of course, if this is the purpose, it's of no use. It will have its counter effect on mm-hmm. him.
I see. Thank you very much, Javi,
thank you
for your nice contribution and participation in the program of Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. From me and the rest of the crew, we say wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
Rahmanun Rahimun Mannanun Kareemun Salamun Aleemun Man La ilaha illa hum Ghaffarun Jameelun Wahhabun Latifun Tawwabun Sami'un Basir La ilaha illa hum وحيد قدير محيي مميت الظاهر والباطن لا إله إلا هو لا إله إلا هو.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent. And FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.